Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Books by my guest today have been translated into 30 languages and sold more than 13 million copies. Jennifer Reed Hawthorne is an international speaker, an author, editor, and writing coach. At Louisiana State University, she studied journalism, broadcasting, and public speaking, then moved to Washington, D.C. to work for the President's Aviation Advisory Commission, then later joined the Peace Corps. She has appeared on CNN and other national, regional, and local TV radio shows. Her writing ranges from technical software manuals to poetry and articles in national magazines like Ladies Home Journal. Jennifer Reed Hawthorne is co-author of Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul, Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul. Both books reached number one on the New York Times and number one and two on USA Today's bestseller lists. Her latest book is Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. She was the keynote speaker at Enloe Medical Center's recent wellness event, Heart of a Woman. Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, welcome.
Thank you so much, Nancy. It's a joy to be here.
Well, I could see, based on your upbringing, why you might want to major in journalism at college.
You can. Well, yes, I was born to some very articulate parents. My mother was British, and she had a beautiful command of the English language. And my father was an extremely intelligent man in the broadcast field himself. He was quite a journalist, and he was also a master storyteller. I think that that is probably one of the biggest influences on me and the work that I have ended up doing, you know, having authored or co-authored or edited 7 books now, most of them collections of stories. It was such an extraordinary experience as a child to have my father tell us his original Brer Rabbit stories every night. That was my bedtime story time. During his life, my father wrote a little over 500 original Brer Rabbit stories. He used to tell them on the Liberty Network, which was a national network, when I was just very, very young. And I have vivid memories of my middle sister and me stretched out on our twin beds, my father sitting on the floor between us telling us stories. And of course, when we would get tired, you know, of the 520 stories that he had written, we would say, "Tell us something new, Daddy, tell us something new." And he'd say, "Okay, you give me the storyline." And we would have to come up with a plot, and then he would create a story right there on the spot. So I think it was really in my blood. And then, of course, later, I know you know that I went into the Peace Corps. You just mentioned that. And I lived for 2 years in a culture that where the passing of the culture was done in an oral way through the medium of storytelling. And I think that was a tremendous influence on me as well.
Well, to go back a little farther in history, there was a journalist in Atlanta, Joel Chandler Harris. And, of course, I never heard his stories told orally, but his written stories just came to life in me. I could hear, because I grew up with the rhythms of this language of Uncle Remus. And it was beautiful to me. And the way Joel Chandler Harris was able to reproduce on paper how that sounded, I just was always amazed at his talent at doing that. And so I was so very curious as to when your father wrote, because I assume when he's telling the stories, he could do it in an accent.
Oh, yes. And he did all of the voices of all the characters, and he created some new characters. And, of course, for people wondering, these characters they're sourced in folklore. And so, you know, they're not subject to copyright law or anything like that. Anybody can write a Brer Rabbit story. My father
In fact, a lot of people did. I've seen different versions.
Yes.
And the ones by Joel Chandler Harris stood out for me because the others paled. They would tell the same storyline, but he could bring it to life in a way that this matter of fact, well, there was a rabbit and there was a tar baby, and his came to life. So I thought about this fact that you went to West Africa because in Georgia, that's where these stories, these folk tales came from Africa, this trickster rabbit.
Of course, of course. And I grew up in Louisiana, where, I don't know, I think that there's something about that culture of storytelling, particularly with all the Southern dialect, that is particularly meaningful to me.
My guest is Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, and she has written a lot of books. One of them is Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. She is a writer, speaker, and educator with a passion for exploring consciousness and the development of human potential. And that's what your books are about, and you use these stories to illustrate these points you're making. Now, when you went to Washington, though, you worked for the Aviation Advisory Committee?
Yes, but let's back up. It's not quite as glamorous as it seems. You know, when I moved to Washington in the late 60s after college, I did that because I was very politically active and I wanted to be as close to the political scene as I could. And there was no better place in the world, really, than Washington, D.C., where, you know, the local news was the national news.
I remember, you know, when I was in Washington myself thinking, you turn on the TV and you're absolutely right. It's the local news is the national news.
Yes. But I actually had a job as what was then known as a Kelly girl, you know, where temporary assignments.
Yes, I remember Kelly.
And I got this fantastic job working for the President's Aviation Commission. Aviation Advisory Commission was the full name of it. It was a special commission set up by President Nixon at the time, and it was just fantastic. But the most interesting thing that happened to me during those days, Nancy, was that, you know, I was living this wonderful, just rich life. I was out of college. I was out of the South. I was doing something so new, living in a big city. And every day I would walk from my home in DuPont Circle downtown to this job. And I would pass these beautifully landscaped yards and buildings and these magnificent government buildings. And one day I started having this thought, there must be something more to life than this. It was just the oddest thing, and it wouldn't let go of me. And I had that every day, and I had a wonderful relationship. Life was just so exciting and fulfilling. And every day I would walk past the Peace Corps building, and one day I found myself stopping in front of the door into the Peace Corps building, and I thought, what am I doing? And I walked in, and I picked up an application. And then over the next few weeks, I actually filled it out, and then I got accepted. And, you know, I write about this in my books, this kind of thing, because to me, that is the voice of intuition that so many of us just completely forget to listen to or think is not important or not meaningful. And I have really come to realize that when a thought comes through my head, pay attention, no matter how mundane it is. I'll give you a couple of examples. I mean, that, of course, ended up being what I would call one of those destiny points in life for me, because I did get accepted into the Peace Corps, and then I had to decide, am I going to leave this fantastic life, you know, to go jump into the unknown? And I did. I was just compelled to do it. And I think it was that little voice inside of me that was telling me that I really didn't have a choice. This was to be my destiny. And of course, that led to everything that I've done since then. But, you know, this kind of thing can take its form in the tiniest of things. And I'll give you an example. Right before coming out to California from Florida, where I live now, two thoughts went through my head. One was that I should take a pair of slippers with me because I'm not used to dressing for the cold. And the other was something else that I needed to bring, that I really needed to bring. I don't remember what it is right now. And what I have discovered is that usually I feel as though there is something called a higher self. Some people might call that intuition or the soul speaking to us or something like that. I think it takes really, really good care of us if we just pay attention. But what I've learned is that sometimes it only speaks once. And I forgot to pack my slippers. And I just came up from the Bay Area where it rained for 2 days and was so cold, I was absolutely miserable. And so this, you know, we're talking about here two examples, one a very big one and one a very tiny one. But I think that as I mature, as I age, I'm learning that it's really important. It's really valuable to listen to that voice. It doesn't mean that we have to act on it. I think intuition can be wrong sometimes. I know that that kind of is contrary to what a lot of people say. Oh, always listen to your intuition. It's never wrong. I don't believe that, actually, but I think it's worth listening to.
My guest is Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, and she is author of numerous books. One, Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. And her personal quest for peace and transformation has taken her around the world, from Baton Rouge to Kathmandu, from Mother Teresa to the Maasai. And when you were talking about this moment when you had to decide, am I really going to go to West Africa? Because I think a lot of people make changes like that because they're forced into it. Maybe they're fired from a job, which can lead to an even better job, but they don't know that at that moment. And that's why I think what you did takes courage to say goodbye to something that was working perfectly fine for you.
Indeed.
Your life was going really well.
Yes.
And then you don't know, maybe West Africa is going to be not what I thought it would be. Maybe being the Peace Corps is not what I thought it would be. But you had the courage to say, okay, I'm making this decision.
Well, you know, I've thought about that word courage a lot. In fact, I wrote about it in Life Lessons, and I wrote about it in the second to last book that I did called The Soul of Success. I don't know that it really took courage for me to do that. I'm not sure that courage comes into play when you are at one of those destiny points where it seems as if there's no choice. Does that take courage? I'm not sure. I think it's a wonderful discussion. I think as I grow older, I realize I don't have all the answers. But I think that courage is something that can benefit all of us. I have a chapter, you know, in my last books about courage. I think probably most of my seven books really talk about courage. I think that courage is the opposite of fear. And I think that one of the best things that we can do as human beings is whatever it takes to transform fear into its opposite. And if that's courage, then great.
Well, you have a quote from Helen Keller, "The only way out of fear is through it."
Mm.
And I also was impressed by your saying the example of how the universe organizes once a vision is clear. You gave an example that the universe kind of, I think about it sometimes like the Red Sea. You know, you can't, it's a wall of water there, but then if you start walking, it parts and the universe arranges, like you just say in your book, or the universe organizes once the vision is clear, and usually beyond anything we could ever imagine or plan. As we're sitting here right there at this moment, that's exactly what happened with this radio show. I had begun to get this vague notion of something, an idea that I had, but it wasn't very clear at first. I went to the program director and talked to him about it. And then once I started doing it, I was amazed at how easy it was because everything fell into place.
Mm, I love that. It's a perfect example.
So I can see from my own experience the truth of so much of what you say in your books mm-hmm. and in your talks.
Thank you. And, you know, I think that it's also really valuable to look at, what happens if I'm not clear? What do I mm-hmm. do? And I think the answer to that is to ask. You can ask a deity, if a deity is important to you and part of your life. You can ask your higher self. You can just throw it out to the universe. I love that word, the universe. Whoever
it includes
is
everything.
There. Yes, exactly. Some people believe that we have lots of guides, you know, on other levels. And whether that's true or not is immaterial. I think just asking for clarity about something can often bring us the answer. And I've heard many people suggest that we do it before we go to sleep at night, just sort of throw it out there. Okay, whoever's listening, I would like clarity about this particular issue. And I know that for many people, the answers are there the next morning or the next day or maybe over the next few days, but the answers will come. And I think another key piece to it, Nancy, is to wait as long as possible. I mean, sometimes we don't have that luxury if we're under a deadline or something like that. But I think that I love the phrase, when in doubt, leave it out. I try to use that when I'm faced with a decision that I'm having a lot of trouble making. If I'm having trouble making it, that's a sign for me not to make it yet or to say no because mm-hmm. it's not right. Maybe it will be at some point, but the timing is not right right now.
My guest is Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, and she's written a lot of books. One, Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. And I've been, based on just my own experience, found that there's kind of a spectrum of first I'm thinking, no, maybe I won't do this. And then, well, maybe I will do this. And then I reach the past the point, yeah, I think I will. And once I've made the decision, yes, I will, then I find confirmation coming from other sources that I think, oh, okay, this was the right decision because these other little signs of confirmation arrive after I've made the decision.
Very nice. Yeah.
Well, since I teach yoga, I was interested in the fact that you say that you can learn the language of your body.
Mm.
And you say, make this connection, love your body, love yourself. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for people as to what do you mean by learning the language of your body, for example?
Mm. Oh, I love that question. Well, it's something that I'm continuing to learn. What I notice more and more is that my body just gives me answers. Now, let's say if I'm about to give a keynote address, for example, sometimes I might have butterflies. And you'd say, really, Jennifer? You've been doing this for how many years now?
20 years.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, sometimes I have butterflies. But I know the difference between butterflies as sort of a little nervous thing that's going to disappear within the first 5 seconds of me standing up in front of a group, and the feeling of not being prepared. There's a difference. I can feel it in my body. I pay attention. So, for example, when I was speaking at the Enlo event last Thursday night, I noticed, even though I had very little preparation time, that I felt extremely calm in my body. I never felt nervous about it. And I knew that everything was going to go very, very well. I was renting a car and driving from the Bay Area up to Chico. I don't normally do that when I go out for a keynote address. I don't like to drive in strange places. But in my body, I felt completely fine about it. I never felt nervous about it. And I knew that it was going to be okay. And indeed, it was. It was just a flawless trip, even getting out of the city and onto the highways to come north. And that's what I'm starting to notice. I've known this principle for a long, long time, but I feel as though I'm finally starting to really grasp what it means. And if my body feels uncomfortable, let's say my heart feels a little constricted, or there's some sensation in my solar plexus about something, that might be a sign. That is a sign for me to pay attention. Now, what does it mean? I'm going to have to interpret that. But at least it's a signal to me to stop and consider what the issue is or the event or the person that I'm going to meet, whatever that sensation is in reaction to, and just listen, just pay attention. I think our bodies know so much. I really do.
In fact, it's been surprising to me because I can think of a couple of instances. One, when my body says, yes, you're on the right track, go with this. And it was when I sat behind this microphone one day before I started this show, and my body said, oh, this is so comfortable. And my body, it was like a sigh of comfort in my body. So I thought, okay, that's a green light. And then I remember one time when I decided to make a trip down to the Bay Area, and I figured my logic said, okay, this is the weekend to go. I need to do this. This was all logic. And then I walked through the room, and I caught a glimpse of my bag. Just it kind of caught me off guard, and my body went, oh, no, do we really have to do this? And so I thought, okay, no, we don't. I'm not going. Mm-hmm. And those are two incidents where my body, in one case, gave me a green light, and another case gave me a red light. And I could feel in my body what it was telling me. In spite of, and overruling what my head had concluded.
Oh, I just love that. And I think that it's so valuable for us to really pay attention to this because we do tend to be such a mental society. We really live in our heads. You know, we're in front of computers all day long and We make up stories about ourselves and our lives, and we cling to them. And the more we can pay attention to what's going on in the body, I think the more successful life is going to be, and the happier and more fulfilled life is going to be. And I love what you just said. It reminds me of how I feel when I get up in front of a group. When I am in front of a group speaking, I feel the most natural in the world. And, you know, speaking is said to be the number one fear.
Yes,
that most people in our country have. You know what number three on that list is? It's dying. So people
would rather die.
That's right. They would rather die than get up in front of a group and speak. But I actually started speaking when I was about 7 years old. I don't remember this, but my father told me that when I was very young, around seven, I used to line up all the kids in my neighborhood on the driveway, make them sit in rows so that I could talk to them. And then, you know, as an adult, I got so far away from that. I mean, of course, at 7 years old, it didn't occur to me that that could be a career, you know, that could actually be a passion. But I think that's another principle that we're kind of getting into now that is very, very important. It has been very important in my work, in my realizations, in my life, because I really got so off track. I mean, for 10 years, I got into the field of accounting.
Oh.
And I did okay at it. You know, I was really pretty good at it. And I loved many things about the orderliness and the balancing, you know, of the whole accounting world. But, oh my gosh, what a relief it was to realize that I really wanted to start speaking to groups. And after Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul came out, then that was just a natural stepping stone for me to get back into that field.
I couldn't help but smile when you were talking about what you were doing at seven, because I've been a teacher all my life. And when I was seven, I was trying to get my younger brother to participate to be a student, and I was the teacher. He wasn't interested, but a neighborhood child was, and she grew up to be a teacher too, so the two of us had great fun.
I love it. And you know, to me, for anybody in the listening audience who is really at a transition point, or, you know, if you feel that you are not happy in the work that you're doing, and you really would love to discover what your purpose is, I use that word cautiously, but if you're looking for something really fulfilling and don't have a clue what it is, I really strongly urge you to look back at your childhood and look at the things that you loved doing, the things that inspired you, the things that excited you. I think there can be some real insight there for us.
Before you knew what you were supposed to do.
Exactly.
Or like.
Exactly.
Because part of what you say, too, is to let go of judgments. You say gain freedom through acceptance and release of judgment. I don't know if people think about that, the fact that you can give yourself freedom by not indulging in judgments.
Oh my gosh, this is one of my favorite ideas and concepts in life. I'm so glad you brought it up, Nancy. I love, there's a beautiful Rumi quote about this. He says, out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. And I just think that is so exquisite. I think that one of the things that I've learned through the years is that whenever we are in opposition to anything, what we really do is allow for the perpetuation of the argument or the conflict. So, for example, when I was in college, I was very much involved in the anti-war movement. And what I realize now, looking back, is that I was perpetuating the side that was in favor of war. I remember taking a wonderful seminar once called Redirecting Children's Behavior, and one category of child is the power struggle child. And you learn to deal with someone who's a power struggle being by not engaging in the power struggle. You don't set up an opposing side. And there can't be any conflict when that happens. And what I've come to be very grateful for is this learning that I know I have my beliefs. I know that I have my values, but that does not mean for one second that they need to be anybody else's beliefs or values. And someone can have the opposite values from me, and there was a time when I would have thought, oh, you're just wrong. And you know what?
Or people feel threatened by it.
Yes.
I think some people feel threatened by the fact that somebody has an opposing view.
Yes, of course. And I feel so grateful for not feeling that way anymore, because I know that I really did at one time. And now I just know that
you're free from that.
I'm free. So there's no conflict. No conflict gets created within me, no tension. And that really, I think, is a way to live a peaceful life, which is very, very important to me.
My guest is Jennifer Reed Hawthorne, and one of her books, Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. And so you encourage people to not be searching outside of themselves for happiness?
Yes. Isn't that such a beautiful thing? I think that from the time we're very, very young, we are taught as a culture to look outside ourselves for things to make us happy, for things to base our self-esteem on. This was a major theme of the talk at the conference Thursday night. And I think in our society, we tend to look at our families. We base our self-esteem and our happiness on the way we look, on the way we're aging. For women, it's about relationships. For men, it's about jobs and money and status and these kinds of things. And the problem with looking to anything external for happiness or for self-esteem or for worth is that they're always changing. Things on the outside cannot possibly be a foundation for anything because they're just not stable. You know, we can have our families, and maybe it's our families that make us feel worthy, but families change. Jobs change. People move. You know, families fall apart. Relationships fall apart. So to me, one of the most beautiful definitions of self-esteem that I've ever heard is that self-esteem is the internal feeling of being lovable, worthy, and capable. And I think that the more we can cultivate a sense of, I am just good enough and I'm happy no matter what my circumstances are, oh my gosh, is that so freeing. Like right now, I moved from a 3,000 square foot home to an 1,800 square foot condo in Florida. And it was a big change for me. But every day I just go, oh my gosh, it's just so beautiful. And I'm so grateful. Let's be thankful for what we have, who we are. Everything is there inside.
So you're, as long as you live, here's a quote that you have, philosopher Seneca, as long as you live, keep learning how to live. So you're learning how to live in a smaller house.
Yes.
And just when we think we already know everything, we have to learn how to live continually.
Yes. Yes.
It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
My guest has been Jennifer Reed Hawthorne. One of her books, Chicken Soup for the Woman's Soul, and Life Lessons for Loving the Way You Live. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.